ministers of justice, whilst the population is merely a spectator of the conflict. In America, he is looked upon as an enemy of the human race, and the whole of mankind is against him. I believe that provincial institutions are useful to all nations, but nowhere do they appear to me to be more indispensable than amongst a democratic people. In an aristocracy, order can always be maintained in the midst of liberty, and as the rulers have a great deal to lose, order is to them a first-rate consideration. In like manner, an aristocracy protects the people from the excesses of despotism, because it always possesses an organized power ready to resist a despot. But a democracy without provincial institutions has no security against these evils. How can a populace, unaccustomed to freedom in small concerns, learn to use it temperately in great affairs? What resistance can be offered to tyranny in a country where every private individual is impotent, and where the citizens are united by no common tie? Those who dread the license of the mob, and those who fear the rule of absolute power, ought alike to desire the progressive growth of provincial liberties. On the other hand, I am convinced that democratic nations are most exposed to fall beneath the yoke of a central administration for several reasons, amongst which is the following. The constant tendency of these nations is to concentrate all the strength of the government in the hands of the only power which directly represents the people, because beyond the people nothing is to be perceived but a mass of equal individuals confounding together. But when the same power is already in possession of all the attributes of the government, it can scarcely refrain from penetrating into the details of the administration, and an opportunity of doing so is sure to present itself in the end, as was the case in France. In the French Revolution, there were two impulses in opposite directions, which must never be confounded. The one was favorable to liberty, the other to despotism. Under the ancient monarchy, the king was the sole author of the laws, and below the power of the sovereign, certain vestiges of provincial institutions, half destroyed, were still distinguishable. These provincial institutions were incoherent, ill-compacted, and frequently absurd. In the hands of the aristocracy, they had sometimes been converted into instruments of oppression. The revolution declared itself the enemy of royalty and of provincial institutions at the same time. It confounded all that had preceded it, despotic power and the checks to its abuses, in indiscriminate hatred, and its tendency was at once to overthrow and to centralize. This double character of the French Revolution is a fact which has been adroitly handled by the friends of absolute power. Can they be accused of laboring in the cause of despotism when they are defending that central administration which was one of the great innovations of the Revolution? See Appendix K. In this manner, popularity may be conciliated with hostility to the rights of the people, and the secret slave of tyranny may be the professed admirer of freedom. I have visited the two nations in which the system of provincial liberty has been most perfectly established, and I have listened to the opinions of different parties in those countries. In America, I met with men who secretly aspired to destroy the democratic institutions of the Union. In England, I found others who attacked the aristocracy openly, but I know of no one who does not regard provincial independence as a great benefit. In both countries, I have heard a thousand different causes assigned for the evils of the state, but the local system was never mentioned amongst them. I have heard citizens attribute the power and prosperity of their country to a multitude of reasons, but they all placed the advantages of local institutions in the foremost rank. Am I to suppose that when men who are naturally so divided on religious opinions and on political theories agree on one point, and that one of which they have daily experience, they are all in error? The only nations which deny the utility of provincial liberties are those which have fewest of them. In other words, those who are unacquainted with the institution are the only persons who pass a censure upon it. Chapter 6. Judicial Power in the United States and Its Influence on Political Society. I have thought it essential to devote a separate chapter to the judicial authorities of the United States, lest their great political importance should be lessened in the listener's ears by a merely incidental mention of them. Confederations have existed in other countries beside America, and republics have not been established upon the shores of the New World alone. The representative system of government has been adopted in several states of Europe, but I am not aware that any nation of the globe has hitherto organized a judicial power on the principle now adopted by the Americans. The judicial organization of the United States is the institution which a stranger has the greatest difficulty in understanding. He hears the authority of a judge invoked in the political occurrences of every day, and he naturally concludes that in the United States the judges are important political functionaries. Nevertheless, when he examines the nature of the tribunals, they offer nothing which is contrary to the usual habits and privileges of those bodies, and the magistrates seem to him to interfere in public affairs of chance, but by a chance which recurs every day. When the Parliament of Paris remonstrated, or refused to enregister an edict, or when it summoned a functionary accused of malversation to its bar, its political influence as a judicial body was clearly visible. But nothing of the kind is to be seen in the United States. The Americans have retained all the ordinary characteristics of judicial authority and have carefully restricted its action to the ordinary circle of its functions. The first characteristic of judicial power in all nations is the duty of arbitration. But rights must be contested in order to warrant the interference of a tribunal, and an action must be brought to obtain the decision of a judge. As long, therefore, as the law is uncontested, the judicial authority is not called upon to discuss it, and it may exist without being perceived. When a judge in a given case attacks a law relating to that case, he extends the circle of his customary duties without, however, stepping beyond it. Since he is in some measure obliged to decide upon the law in order to decide the case. But if he pronounces upon a law without resting upon a case, he clearly steps beyond his sphere and invades that of the legislative authority. The second characteristic of judicial power is that it pronounces on special cases and not upon general principles. If a judge, in deciding a particular point, destroys a general principle by passing a judgment which tends to reject all the inferences from that principle and consequently to annul it, he remains within the ordinary limits of his functions. But if he directly attacks a general principle without having a particular case in view, he leaves the circle in which all nations have agreed to confine his authority. He assumes a more important and perhaps a more useful influence than that of the magistrate, but he ceases to be a representative of the judicial power. The third characteristic of the judicial power is its inability to act unless it is appealed to, or until it is taken cognizance of an affair. This characteristic is less general than the other two, but notwithstanding the exceptions, I think it may be regarded as essential. The judicial power is by its nature devoid of action. It must be put in motion in order to produce a result. When it is called upon to repress a crime, it punishes the criminal. When a wrong is to be redressed, it is ready to redress it. When an act requires interpretation, it is prepared to interpret it. But it does not pursue criminals, hunt out wrongs, or examine into evidence of its own accord. A judicial functionary who should open proceedings and usurp the censorship of the laws would in some measure do violence to the passive nature of his authority. The Americans have retained these three distinguishing characteristics of the judicial power. An American judge can only pronounce a decision when litigation has arisen. He is only conversant with special cases, and he cannot act until the cause has been duly brought before the court. His position is therefore perfectly similar to that of the magistrate of other nations, and he is nevertheless invested with immense political power. If the sphere of his authority and his means of action are the same as those of other judges, it may be asked whence he derives a power which they do not possess. The cause of this difference lies in the simple fact that Americans have acknowledged the right of the judges to found their decisions on the Constitution rather than on the laws. In other words, they have left them at liberty not to apply such laws as may appear to them to be unconstitutional. I am aware that a similar right has been claimed, but claimed in vain, by courts of justice in other countries, but in America it is recognized by all authorities, and not a party, nor so much as an individual, is found to contest it. This fact can only be explained by the principles of the American Constitution. In France, the Constitution is, or at least is supposed to be, immutable, and the received theory is that no power has the right of changing any part of it. In England, the Parliament has an acknowledged right to modify the Constitution. As, therefore, the Constitution may undergo perpetual changes, it does not, in reality, exist. The Parliament is at once a legislative and a constituent assembly. The political theories of America are more simple and more rational. An American Constitution is not supposed to be immutable, as in France, nor is it susceptible of modification by the ordinary powers of society, as in England. It constitutes a detached whole, which, as it represents the determination of the whole people, is no less binding on the legislator than on the private citizen, but which may be altered by the will of the people in predetermined cases, according to established rules. In America, the Constitution may therefore vary, but as long as it exists, it is the origin of all authority and the sole vehicle of the predominating force. It is easy to perceive in what manner these differences must act upon the position and the rights of the judicial bodies in the three countries I have cited. If in France the tribunals were authorized to disobey the laws on the ground of their being opposed to the Constitution, the supreme power would in fact be placed in their hands, since they alone would have the right of interpreting a constitution, the clauses of which can be modified by no authority. They would therefore take the place of the nation and exercise as absolute a sway over society as the inherent weakness of judicial power would allow them to do. Undoubtedly, as the French judges are incompetent to declare a law to be unconstitutional, the power of changing the Constitution is indirectly given to the legislative body, since no legal barrier would oppose the alterations which it might prescribe. But it is better to grant the power of changing the Constitution of the people to men who represent, however imperfectly, the will of the people, than to men who represent no one but themselves. It would be still more unreasonable to invest the English judges with the right of resisting the decisions of the legislative body, since the Parliament, which makes the laws, also makes the Constitution, and, consequently, a law emanating from the three powers of the state can in no case be unconstitutional. But neither of these remarks is applicable to America. In the United States, the Constitution governs the legislator as much as the private citizen. As it is the first of laws, it cannot be modified by a law, and it is therefore just that the tribunals should obey the Constitution in preference to any law. This condition is essential to the power of the judicature, for to select that legal obligation by which he is most strictly bound is the natural right of every magistrate. In France, the Constitution is also the first of laws, and the judges have the same right to take it as the ground of their decisions. But were they to exercise this right, they must perforce encroach on rights more sacred than their own, namely, on those of society, in whose name they are acting. In this case, the state motive clearly prevails over the motives of an individual. In America, where the nation can always reduce its magistrates to obedience by changing its constitution, no danger of this kind is to be feared. Upon this point, therefore, the political and the logical reasons agree, and the people, as well as the judges, preserve their privileges. Whenever a law which the judge holds to be unconstitutional is argued in a tribunal of the United States, he may refuse to admit it as a rule. This power is the only one which is peculiar to the American magistrate, but it gives rise to immense political influence. Few laws can escape the searching analysis of the judicial power for any length of time, for there are few which are not prejudicial to some private interest or other, and none which may not be brought before a court of justice by the choice of parties or by the necessity of the case. But from the time that a judge has refused to apply any given law in a case, that law loses a portion of its moral cogency. The persons to whose interests it is prejudicial learn that means exist of evading its authority, and similar suits are multiplied until it becomes powerless. One of the two alternatives must then be resorted to. The people must alter the Constitution, or the legislature must repeal the law. The political power which the Americans have entrusted to their courts of justice is therefore immense. But the evils of this power are considerably diminished by the obligation which has been imposed of attacking the laws through the courts of justice alone. If the judge had been empowered to contest the laws on the ground of theoretical generalities, if he had been enabled to open an attack or pass a censure on the legislator, he would have played a prominent part in the political sphere. And as the champion or the antagonist of a party, he would have arrayed the hostile passions of the nation in the conflict. But when a judge contests a law applied to some particular case in an obscure proceeding, the importance of his attack is concealed from the public gaze. His decision bears upon the interest of an individual, and if the law is slighted, it is only collaterally. Moreover, although it is censured, it is not abolished. Its moral force may be diminished, but its cogency is by no means suspended, and its final destruction can only be accomplished by the reiterated attacks of judicial functionaries. It will readily be understood that by connecting the censorship of the laws with the private interests of members of the community, and by intimately uniting the prosecution of the law with the prosecution of an individual, legislation is protected from wanton assailants and from the daily aggressions of party spirit. The errors of the legislator are exposed whenever their evil consequences are most felt, and it is always a positive and appreciable fact which serves as the basis of a prosecution. I am inclined to believe this practice of the American courts to be at once the most favorable to liberty as well as to public order. If the judge could only attack the legislator openly and directly, he would sometimes be afraid to oppose any resistance to his will, and at other moments party spirit might encourage him to brave it at every turn. The laws would consequently be attacked when the power from which they emanate is weak, and obeyed when it is strong. That is to say, when it would be useful to respect them, they would be contested, and when it would be easy to convert them into an instrument of oppression, they would be respected. But the American judge is brought into the political arena independently of his own will. He only judges the law because he is obliged to judge a case. The political question which he is called upon to resolve is connected with the interest of the suitors, and he cannot refuse to decide it without abdicating the duties of his post. He performs his functions as a citizen by fulfilling the precise duties which belong to his profession as a magistrate. It is true that upon this system the judicial censorship, which is exercised by the courts of justice over the legislation, cannot extend to all laws indiscriminately, inasmuch as some of them can never give rise to that exact species of contestation which is termed in a lawsuit. And even when such a contestation is possible, it may happen that no one cares to bring it before a court of justice. The Americans have often felt this disadvantage, but they have left the remedy incomplete, lest they should give it an efficacy which might in some cases prove dangerous. Within these limits, the power vested in the American courts of justice of pronouncing a statute to be unconstitutional forms one of the most powerful barriers which has ever been devised against the tyranny of political assemblies. Other powers granted to American judges. It is perfectly natural that in a free country like America, all the citizens should have the right of indicting public functionaries before the ordinary tribunals, and that all the judges should have the power of punishing public offenses. The right granted to the courts of justice of judging the agents of the executive government when they have violated the laws is so natural a one that it cannot be looked upon as an extraordinary privilege. Nor do the springs of government appear to me to be weakened in the United States by the custom which renders all public officers responsible to the judges of the land. The Americans seem, on the contrary, to have increased by this means that respect which is due to the authorities, and at the same time to have rendered those who are in power more scrupulous of offending public opinion. I was struck by the small number of political trials which occur in the United States, but I had no difficulty in accounting for this circumstance. A lawsuit, of whatever nature it may be, is always a difficult and expensive undertaking. It is easy to attack a public man in a journal, but the motives which can warrant an action at law must be serious. A solid ground of complaint must therefore exist to induce an individual to prosecute a public officer, and public officers are careful not to furnish these grounds of complaint when they are afraid of being prosecuted. This does not depend upon the republican form of American institutions, for the same facts present themselves in England. These two nations do not regard the impeachment of the principal officers of state as a sufficient guarantee of their independence, but they hold that the right of minor prosecutions, which are within the reach of the whole community, is a better pledge of freedom than those great judicial actions which are rarely employed until it is too late. In the Middle Ages, when it was very difficult to overtake offenders, the judges inflicted the most dreadful tortures on the few who were arrested, which by no means diminished the number of crimes. It has since been discovered that when justice is more certain and more mild, it is at the same time more efficacious. The English and the Americans hold that tyranny and oppression are to be treated like any other crime, by lessening the penalty and facilitating conviction. In the year 8 of the French Republic, a constitution was drawn up in which the following clause was introduced. Article 75. All the agents of the government, below the rank of ministers, can only be prosecuted for offenses relating to their several functions by the virtue of a decree of the Conseil d'État, in which the case the prosecution takes place before the ordinary tribunals. This clause survived the Constitution de l'Ennui, and it is still maintained in spite of the just complaints of the nation. I have always found the utmost difficulty in explaining its meaning to Englishmen or Americans. They were at once led to conclude that the Conseil d'État in France was a great tribunal established in the center of the kingdom, which exercised a preliminary and somewhat tyrannical jurisdiction in all political causes. But when I told them that the Conseil d'État was not a judicial body, in the common sense of the term, but an administrative council composed of men dependent on the crown, so that the king, after having ordered one of his servants, called a prefect, to commit an injustice, has the power of commanding another of his servants, called a counselor of state, to prevent the former from being punished. When I demonstrated to them that the citizen who has been injured by the order of the sovereign is obliged to solicit from the sovereign permission to obtain redress, they refused to credit so flagrant an abuse, and were tempted to accuse me of falsehood or of ignorance. It frequently happened before the Revolution that a parliament issued a warrant against a public officer who had committed an offense, and sometimes the proceedings were stopped by the authority of the crown, which enforced compliance with its absolute and despotic will. It is painful to perceive how much lower we are sunk than our forefathers, since we allow things to pass under the color of justice and the sanction of the law which violence alone could impose upon them. Chapter 7. Political Jurisdiction in the United States. Political Jurisdiction in the United States. I understand by political jurisdiction that temporary right of pronouncing a legal decision with which a political body may be invested. In absolute governments, no utility can accrue from the introduction of extraordinary forms of procedure. The prince, in whose name an offender is prosecuted, is as much the sovereign of the courts of justice as of everything else, and the idea which is entertained of his power is of itself a sufficient security. The only thing he has to fear is that the external formalities of justice should be neglected, and that his authority should be dishonored from a wish to render it more absolute. But in most free countries, in which the majority can never exercise the same influence upon the tribunals as an absolute monarch, the judicial power has occasionally been vested for a time in the representatives of the nation. It has been thought better to introduce a temporary confusion between the functions of the different authorities than to violate the necessary principle of the unity of government. England, France, and the United States have established this political jurisdiction by law, and it is curious to examine the different adaptations which these three great nations have made of the principle. In England and in France, the House of Lords and the Chambre de Paris, as it existed under the constitutional monarchy down to 1848, constitute the highest criminal court of their respective nations, and although they do not habitually try all political offenses, they are competent to try them all. Another political body enjoys the right of impeachment before the House of Lords. The only difference which exists between the two countries in this respect is that in England the Commons may impeach whomsoever they please before the Lords, whilst in France the deputies can only employ this mode of prosecution against the ministers of the Crown. In both countries, the upper house may make use of all the existing penal laws of the nation to punish the delinquents. In the United States, as well as in Europe, one branch of the legislature is authorized to impeach and another to judge. The House of Representatives arraigns the offender, and the Senate awards his sentence. But the Senate can only try such persons as are brought before it by the House of Representatives, and those persons must belong to the class of public functionaries. Thus, the jurisdiction of the Senate is less extensive than that of the peers of France, whilst the right of impeachment by the representatives is more general than that of the deputies. But the great difference which exists between Europe and America is that in Europe, political tribunals are empowered to inflict all the dispositions of the penal code, while in America, when they have deprived the offender of his official rank and have declared him incapable of filling any political office for the future, their jurisdiction terminates and that of the ordinary tribunals begins. Suppose, for instance, that the President of the United States has committed the crime of high treason. The House of Representatives impeaches him, and the Senate degrades him. He must then be tried by a jury, which alone can deprive him of his liberty or his life. This accurately illustrates the subject we are treating. The political jurisdiction, which is established by the laws of Europe, is intended to try great offenders, whatever may be their birth, their rank, or their powers in the state. And, to this end, all the privileges of the courts of justice are temporarily extended to a great political assembly. The legislator is then transformed into the magistrate. He is called upon to admit, to distinguish, and to punish the offense. And, as he exercises all the authority of a judge, the law restricts him to the observance of all the duties of that high office and of all the formalities of justice. When a public functionary is impeached before an English or a French political tribunal and is found guilty, the sentence deprives him ipso facto of his functions, and it may pronounce him to be incapable of resuming them or any others for the future. But in this case, the political interdict is a consequence of the sentence, and not the sentence itself. In Europe, the sentence of a political tribunal is to be regarded as a judicial verdict rather than as an administrative measure. In the United States, the contrary takes place, and although the decision of the Senate is judicial in its form, since the senators are obliged to comply with the practices and formalities of a court of justice, although it is judicial in respect to the motives on which it is founded, since the Senate is in general obliged to take an offense at common law as the basis of its sentence, nevertheless, the object of the proceeding is purely administrative. If it had been the intention of the American legislator to invest a political body with great judicial authority, its action would not have been limited to the circle of public functionaries, since the most dangerous enemies of the state may be in possession of no functions at all. And this is especially true in republics, where the party influence is the first of authorities, and where the strength of many a listener is increased by his exercising no legal power. If it had been the intention of the American legislator to give society the means of repressing state offenses by exemplary punishment, according to the practice of ordinary justice, the resources of the penal code would all have been placed at the disposal of the political tribunals. But the weapon with which they are entrusted is an imperfect one, and it can never reach the most dangerous offenders, since men who aim at the entire subversion of the laws are not likely to murmur at a political interdict. The main object of the political jurisdiction which obtains in the United States is, therefore, to deprive the ill-disposed citizen of an authority which he has used amiss, and to prevent him from ever acquiring it again. This is evidently an administrative measure sanctioned by the formalities of a judicial decision. In this matter, the Americans have created a mixed system. They have surrounded the act which removes a public functionary with the securities of a political trial, and they have deprived all political condemnations of their severest penalties. Every link of the system may easily be traced from this point. We at once perceive why the American constitutions subject all the civil functionaries to the jurisdiction of the Senate, whilst the military, whose crimes are nevertheless more formidable, are exempted from that tribunal. In the civil service, none of the American functionaries can be said to be removable. The places which some of them occupy are inalienable, and the others are chosen for a term which cannot be shortened. It is therefore necessary to try them all in order to deprive them of their authority. But military officers are dependent on the chief magistrate of the state, who is himself a civil functionary, and the decision which condemns him is a blow upon them all. If we now compare the American and the European systems, we shall meet with differences no less striking in the different effects which each of them produces or may produce. In France and in England, the jurisdiction of political bodies is looked upon as an extraordinary resource, which is only to be employed in order to rescue society from unwanted dangers. It is not to be denied that these tribunals, as they are constituted in Europe, are apt to violate the conservative principle of the balance of power in the state, and to threaten incessantly the lives and liberties of the subject. The same political jurisdiction in the United States is only indirectly hostile to the balance of power. It cannot menace the lives of the citizens, and it does not hover, as in Europe, over the heads of the community, since those only who have submitted to its authority on accepting office are exposed to the severity of its investigations. It is, at the same time, less formidable and less efficacious. Indeed, it has not been considered by the legislators of the United States as a remedy for the more violent evils of society, but as an ordinary means of conducting the government. In this respect, it probably exercises more real influence on the social body in America than in Europe. We must not be misled by the apparent mildness of the American legislation in all that relates to political jurisdiction. It is to be observed, in the first place, that in the United States the tribunal which passes sentence is composed of the same elements and subject to the same influences as the body which impeaches the offender, and that this uniformity gives an almost irresistible impulse to the vindictive passions of parties. If political judges in the United States cannot inflict such heavy penalties as those of Europe, there is the less chance of their acquitting a prisoner. And the conviction, if it is less formidable, is more certain. The principal object of the political tribunals of Europe is to punish the offender. The purpose of those in America is to deprive him of his authority. A political condemnation in the United States may, therefore, be looked upon as a preventative measure, and there is no reason for restricting the judges to exact definitions of criminal law. Nothing can be more alarming than the excessive latitude with which political offenses are described in the laws of America. Article 2, Section 4 of the Constitution of the United States runs thus: "The President, Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for, and conviction of, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors." Many constitutions of the states are even less explicit. "Public officers," says the Constitution of Massachusetts, "shall be impeached for misconduct or maladministration." The Constitution of Virginia declares that all the civil officers who shall have offended against the state by maladministration, corruption, or other high crimes may be impeached by the House of Delegates. In some constitutions, no offenses are specified, in order to subject the public functionaries to an unlimited responsibility. But I will venture to affirm that it is precisely their mildness which renders the American laws most formidable in this respect. We have shown that in Europe the removal of a functionary and his political interdiction are the consequences of the penalty he is to undergo, and that in America they constitute the penalty itself. The consequence is that in Europe political tribunals are invested with rights which they are afraid to use, and that the fear of punishing too much hinders them from punishing at all. But in America no one hesitates to inflict a penalty from which humanity does not recoil. To condemn a political opponent to death in order to deprive him of his power is to commit what all the world would execrate as a horrible assassination. But to declare that opponent unworthy to exercise that authority, to deprive him of it, and to leave him uninjured in life and limb, may be judged to be the fair issue of the struggle. But this sentence, which it is so easy to pronounce, is not the less fatally severe to the majority of those upon whom it is inflicted. Great criminals may undoubtedly brave its intangible rigor, but ordinary offenders will dread it as a condemnation which destroys their position in the world, casts a blight upon their honor, and condemns them to a shameful inactivity worse than death. The influence exercised in the United States upon the progress of society by the jurisdiction of political bodies may not appear to be formidable, but it is only the more immense. It does not directly coerce the subject, but it renders the majority more absolute over those in power. It does not confer an unbounded authority on the legislator which can be exerted at some momentous crisis, but it establishes a temperate and regular influence which is at all times available. If the power is decreased, it can, on the other hand, be more conveniently employed and more easily abused. By preventing political tribunals from inflicting judicial punishments, the Americans seem to have eluded the worst consequences of legislative tyranny, rather than tyranny itself. And I am not sure that political jurisdiction, as it is constituted in the United States, is not the most formidable weapon which has ever been placed in the rude grasp of a popular majority. When the American republics begin to degenerate, it will be easy to verify the truth of this observation by remarking whether the number of political impeachments augments. See Appendix N. Chapter 8. The Federal Constitution. I have hitherto considered each state as a separate whole, and I have explained the different springs which the people sets in motion, and the different means of action which it employs. But all the states which I have considered as independent are forced to submit, in certain cases, to the supreme authority of the Union. The time is now come for me to explain separately the supremacy with which the Union has been invested, and to cast a rapid glance over the Federal Constitution. History of the Federal Constitution. The 13 colonies which simultaneously threw off the yoke of England towards the end of the last century professed, as I have already observed, the same religion, the same language, the same customs, and almost the same laws. They were struggling against a common enemy, and these reasons were sufficiently strong to unite them one to another and to consolidate them into one nation. But as each of them had enjoyed a separate existence and a government within its own control, the peculiar interests and customs which resulted from this system were opposed to a compact and intimate union which would have absorbed the individual importance of each in the general importance of all. Hence arose two opposite tendencies, the one prompting the Anglo-Americans to unite, the other to divide their strength. As long as the war with the mother country lasted, the principle of union was kept alive by necessity. And although the laws which constituted it were defective, the common tie subsisted in spite of their imperfections. Author's note: see the Articles of the First Confederation formed in 1778. This constitution was not adopted by all the states until 1781. But no sooner was peace concluded than the faults of the legislation became manifest, and the state seemed to be suddenly dissolved. Each colony became an independent republic and assumed an absolute sovereignty. The federal government, condemned to impotence by its constitution and no longer sustained by the presence of a common danger, witnessed the outrages offered to its flag by the great nations of Europe, whilst it was scarcely able to maintain its ground against the Indian tribes, and to pay the interest of the debt which had been contracted during the War of Independence. It was already on the verge of destruction when it officially proclaimed its inability to conduct the government and appealed to the constituent authority of the nation. Author's note: Congress made this declaration on February 21, 1787. If America ever approached, for however brief a time, that lofty pinnacle of glory to which the fancy of its inhabitants is wont to point, it was at the solemn moment at which the power of the nation abdicated, as it were, the empire of the land. All ages have furnished the spectacle of a people struggling with energy to win its independence, and the efforts of the Americans in throwing off the English yoke have been considerably exaggerated. Separated from their enemies by 3,000 miles of ocean and backed by a powerful ally, the success of the United States may be more justly attributed to their geographical position than to the valor of their armies or the patriotism of their citizens. It would be ridiculous to compare the American wars to the wars of the French Revolution, or the efforts of the Americans to those of the French when they were attacked by the whole of Europe, without credit and without allies, yet capable of opposing a 20th part of their population to the world, and of bearing the torch of revolution beyond their frontiers whilst they stifled its devouring flame within the bosom of their country. But it is a novelty in the history of society to see a great people turn a calm and scrutinizing eye upon itself. When apprised by the legislature that the wheels of government are stopped, to see it carefully examine the extent of the evil and patiently wait for 2 whole years until a remedy was discovered, which it voluntarily adopted without having wrung a tear or a drop of blood from mankind. At the time when the inadequacy of the first Constitution was discovered, America possessed the double advantage of that calm which had succeeded the effervescence of the Revolution, and of those great men who had led the Revolution to a successful issue. The Assembly, which accepted the task of composing the second Constitution, was small. It consisted of 55 members. Washington, Madison, Hamilton, and the two Morrises were among the number. But George Washington was its president, and it contained the choicest talents and the noblest hearts which had ever appeared in the New World. This national commission, after long and mature deliberation, offered to the acceptance of the people the body of general laws which still rules the Union. All the states adopted it successively. Author's note: it was not adopted by the legislative bodies, but representatives were elected by the people for this sole purpose, and the new constitution was discussed at length in each of these assemblies. The new federal government commenced its functions in 1789 after an interregnum of 2 years. The Revolution of America terminated when that of France began. Summary of the Federal Constitution. The first question which awaited the Americans was intricate and by no means easy of solution. The object was so: to divide the authority of the different states which composed the Union, that each of them should continue to govern itself in all that concerned its internal prosperity, whilst the entire nation, represented by the Union, should continue to form a compact body and to provide for the general exigencies of the people. It was as impossible to determine beforehand, with any degree of accuracy, the share of authority which each of two governments was to enjoy, as to foresee all the incidents in the existence of a nation. The obligations and the claims of the federal government were simple and easily definable. Because the Union had been formed with the express purpose of meeting the general exigencies of the people. But the claims and obligations of the states were, on the other hand, complicated and various, because those governments had penetrated into all the details of social life. The attributes of the federal government were therefore carefully enumerated, and all that was not included amongst them was declared to constitute a part of the privileges of the several governments of the states. Thus the government of the states remained the rule, and that of the Confederation became the exception. It is to be observed that whenever the exclusive right of regulating certain matters is not reserved to Congress by the Constitution, the states may take up the affair until it is brought before the National Assembly. For instance, Congress has the right of making a general law on bankruptcy, which, however, it neglects to do. Each state is then at liberty to make a law for itself. This point has been established by discussion in the law courts and may be said to belong more properly to jurisprudence. But as it was foreseen that, in practice, questions might arise as to the exact limits of this exceptional authority, and that it would be dangerous to submit these questions to the decision of the ordinary courts of justice, established in the states by the states themselves, a high federal court was created. The action of this court is indirect, as we shall hereafter show, which was destined, amongst other functions, to maintain the balance of power which had been established by the Constitution between the two rival governments. Author's note: it is thus that The Federalist, number 45, explains the division of supremacy between the Union and the states. The powers delegated by the Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. The former will be exercised principally on external objects as war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce. The powers reserved to the several states will extend to all the objects which, in the ordinary course of affairs, concern the internal order and prosperity of the state. I shall often have occasion to quote the Federalist in this work. When the bill, which has since become the Constitution of the United States, was submitted to the approval of the people, and the discussions were still pending, three men, who had already acquired a portion of that celebrity which they have since enjoyed, John Jay, Hamilton, and Madison, formed an association with the intention of explaining to the nation the advantages of the measure which was proposed. With this view, they published a series of articles in the shape of a journal, which now form a complete treatise. They entitled their journal The Federalist, a name which has been retained in the work. The Federalist is an excellent book, which ought to be familiar to the statesmen of all countries, although it especially concerns America. Prerogative of the Federal Government. The external relations of a people may be compared to those of private individuals, and they cannot be advantageously maintained without the agency of a single head of a government. The exclusive right of making peace and war, of concluding treaties of commerce, of raising armies and equipping fleets, was granted to the Union. The necessity of a national government was less imperiously felt in the conduct of the internal policy of society. But there are certain general interests which can only be attended to with advantage by a general authority. The Union was invested with the power of controlling the monetary system, of directing the post office, and of opening the great roads which were to establish a communication between the different parts of the country. Author's note: several other privileges of the same kind exist, such as that which empowers the Union to legislate on bankruptcy, to grant patents, and other matters in which its intervention is clearly necessary. The independence of the government of each state was formally recognized in its sphere. Nevertheless, the federal government was authorized to interfere in the internal affairs of the states in a few predetermined cases, in which an indiscreet abuse of their independence might compromise the security of the Union at large. Author's note: even in these cases, its interference is indirect. The Union interferes by means of the tribunals, as will be hereafter shown. Thus, whilst the power of modifying and changing their legislation at pleasure was preserved in all the republics, they were forbidden to enact ex post facto laws or to create a class of nobles in their community. Lastly, as it was necessary that the federal government should be able to fulfill its engagements, it was endowed with an unlimited power of levying taxes. In examining the balance of power as established by the federal constitution, in remarking on the one hand the portion of sovereignty which has been reserved to the several states, and on the other the share of power which the Union has assumed, it is evident that the federal legislators entertained the clearest and most accurate notions on the nature of the centralization of government. The United States form not only a republic, but a confederation. Nevertheless, the authority of the nation is more central than it was in several of the monarchies of Europe when the American Constitution was formed. Take, for instance, the two following examples. 13 Supreme Courts of Justice existed in France, which, generally speaking, had the right of interpreting the law without appeal. And those provinces which were styled pays d'état were authorized to refuse their assent to an impost which had been levied by the sovereign who represented the nation. In the Union, there is but one tribunal to interpret, as there is one legislature to make the laws, and an impost voted by the representatives of the nation is binding upon all the citizens. In these two essential points, therefore, the Union exercises more central authority than the French monarchy possessed, although the Union is only an assemblage of confederate republics. In Spain, certain provinces had the right of establishing a system of custom house duties peculiar to themselves, although that privilege belongs by its very nature to the national sovereignty. In America, the Congress alone had the right of regulating the commercial relations of the states. The government of the Confederation is therefore more centralized in this respect than the Kingdom of Spain. It is true that the power of the crown in France or in Spain was always able to obtain by force whatever the constitution of the country denied, and that the ultimate result was consequently the same. But I am here discussing the theory of the constitution. Federal powers. After having settled the limits within which the federal government was to act, the next point was to determine the powers which it was to exert. Legislative powers. The plan which had been laid down beforehand for the constitutions of the several states was followed in many points in the organization of the powers of the Union. The federal legislature of the Union was composed of a Senate and a House of Representatives. A spirit of conciliation prescribed the observance of distinct principles in the formation of these two assemblies. I have already shown that two contrary interests were opposed to each other in the establishment of the federal constitution. These two interests had given rise to two opinions. It was the wish of one party to convert the Union into a league of independent states, or a sort of Congress, at which the representatives of the several peoples would meet to discuss certain points of their common interests. The other party desired to unite the inhabitants of the American colonies into one sole nation, and to establish a government which should act as the sole representative of the nation, as far as the limited sphere of its authority would permit. The practical consequences of these two theories were exceedingly different. The question was whether a league was to be established instead of a national government. Whether the majority of the state, instead of the majority of the inhabitants of the Union, was to give the law, for every state, the small as well as the great, would then remain in the full enjoyment of its independence and enter the Union upon a footing of perfect equality. If, however, the inhabitants of the United States were to be considered as belonging to one and the same nation, it would be just that the majority of the citizens of the Union should prescribe the law. Of course, the lesser states could not subscribe to the application of this doctrine without, in fact, abdicating their existence in relation to the sovereignty of the Confederation, since they would have passed from the condition of a co-equal with co-legislative authority to that of an insignificant fraction of a great people. But if the former system would have invested them with an excessive authority, the latter would have annulled their influence altogether. Under these circumstances, the result was that the strict rules of logic were evaded, as is usually the case when interests are opposed to arguments. A middle course was hit upon by the legislators, which brought together by force two systems theoretically irreconcilable. The principle of the independence of the states prevailed in the formation of the Senate, and that of the sovereignty of the nation predominated in the composition of the House of Representatives. It was decided that each state would send two senators to Congress, and a number of representatives proportioned to its population. Author's note: every 10 years, Congress fixes anew the number of representatives which each state is to furnish. The total number was 69 in 1789 and 240 in 1833. The Constitution decided that there should not be more than one representative for every 30,000 persons, but no minimum was fixed on. The Congress has not thought fit to augment the number of representatives in proportion to the increase in population. The first act, which was passed on the subject, April 14, 1792, decided that there should be one representative for every 33,000 inhabitants. The last act, which was passed in 1832, fixes the proportion at 1 for 48,000. The population represented is composed of all the freemen and of 3/5 of the slaves. It resulted from this arrangement that the state of New York has at the present day 40 representatives and only 2 senators. The state of Delaware has 2 senators and only 1 representative. The state of Delaware is therefore equal to the state of New York in the Senate, whilst the latter has 40 times the influence of the former in the House of Representatives. Thus, if the minority of the nation preponderates in the Senate, it may paralyze the decisions of the majority represented in the other house, which is contrary to the spirit of constitutional government. These facts show how rare and how difficult it is rationally and logically to combine all the several parts of legislation. In the course of time, different interests arise, and different principles are sanctioned by the same people. And when a general constitution is to be established, these interests and principles are so many natural obstacles to the rigorous application of any political system with all its consequences. The early stages of national existence are the only periods at which it is possible to maintain the complete logic of legislation. And when we perceive a nation in the enjoyment of this advantage, before we hasten to conclude that it is wise, we should do well to remember that it is young. When the Federal Constitution was formed, the interests of independence for the separate states and the interest of union for the whole people were the only 2 conflicting interests which existed amongst the Anglo-Americans, and a compromise was necessarily made between them. It is, however, just to acknowledge that this part of the Constitution has not hitherto produced those evils which might have been feared. All the states are young and contiguous. Their customs, their ideas, and their exigencies are not dissimilar, and the differences which result from their size or inferiority do not suffice to set their interests at variance. The small states have consequently never been induced to league themselves together in the Senate to oppose the designs of the larger ones. And indeed, there is so irresistible an authority in the legitimate expression of the will of a people that the Senate could offer but a feeble opposition to the vote of the majority of the House of Representatives. It must not be forgotten, on the other hand, that it was not in the power of the American legislators to reduce to a single nation the people for whom they were making laws. The object of the Federal Constitution was not to destroy the independence of the states, but to restrain it. By acknowledging the real authority of these secondary communities, and it was impossible to deprive them of it, they disavowed beforehand the habitual use of constraint in enforcing the decisions of the majority. Upon this principle, the introduction of the influence of the states into the mechanism of the federal government was by no means to be wondered at, since it only attested the existence of an acknowledged power, which was to be humored and not forcibly checked. A further difference between the Senate and the House of Representatives. The Senate not only differs from the other house in the principle which it represents, but also in the mode of its election, in the term for which it is chosen, and in the nature of its functions. The House of Representatives is named by the people, the Senate by the legislators of each state. The former is directly elected, the latter is elected by an elected body. The term for which the representatives are chosen is only 2 years, that of the senators is 6. The functions of the House of Representatives are purely legislative, and the only share it takes in the judicial power is in the impeachment of public officers. The Senate cooperates in the work of legislation and tries those political offenses which the House of Representatives submits to its decision. It also acts as the great executive council of the nation. The treaties which are concluded by the President must be ratified by the Senate, and the appointments he may make must be definitely approved by the same body. The executive power. The American legislators undertook a difficult task in attempting to create an executive power dependent on the majority of the people, and nevertheless sufficiently strong to act without restraint in its own sphere. It was indispensable to the maintenance of the republican form of government that the representative of the executive power should be subject to the will of the nation. The president is an elective magistrate. His honor, his property, his liberty, and his life are the securities which the people has for the temperate use of his power. But in the exercise of his authority, he cannot be said to be perfectly independent. The Senate takes cognizance of his relations with foreign powers, and of the distribution of public appointments, so that he can neither be bribed nor can he employ the means of corruption. The legislators of the Union acknowledged that the executive power would be incompetent to fulfill its task with dignity and utility unless it enjoyed a greater degree of stability and of strength than had been granted to it in the separate states. The president is chosen for 4 years, and he may be reelected, so that the chances of a prolonged administration may inspire him with hopeful undertakings for the public good, and with the means of carrying them into execution. The president was made the sole representative of the executive power of the Union, and care was taken not to render his decision subordinate to the vote of a council, a dangerous measure which tends at the same time to clog the action of the government and to diminish its responsibility. The Senate has the right of annulling certain acts of the president, but it cannot compel him to take any steps, nor does it participate in the exercise of the executive power. The action of the legislature on the executive power may be direct, and we have just shown that the Americans carefully obviated this influence. But it may, on the other hand, be indirect. Public assemblies, which have the power of depriving an officer of state of his salary, encroach upon his independence. And, as they are free to make the laws, it is to be feared lest they should gradually appropriate to themselves a portion of that authority which the Constitution had vested in his hands. This dependence of the executive power is one of the defects inherent in republican constitutions. The Americans have not been able to counteract the tendency which legislative assemblies have to get possession of the government, but they have rendered this propensity less irresistible. The salary of the president is fixed at the time of his entering upon office for the whole period of his magistracy. The president is, moreover, provided with a suspensive veto, which allows him to oppose the passing of such laws as might destroy the portion of independence which the Constitution awards him. The struggle between the president and the legislature must always be an unequal one, since the latter is certain of bearing down all resistance by persevering in its plans. But the suspensive veto forces it at least to reconsider the matter, and if the motion be persisted in, it must then be backed by a majority of 2/3 of the whole House. The veto power is, in fact, a sort of appeal to the people. The executive power, which, without this security, might have been secretly oppressed, adopts this means of pleading its cause and stating its motives. But if the legislature is certain of overpowering all resistance by persevering in its plans, I reply that in the constitutions of all nations, of whatever kind they may be, a certain point exists at which the legislator is obliged to have recourse to the good sense and the virtue of his fellow citizens. This point is more prominent and more discoverable in republics, whilst it is more remote and more carefully concealed in monarchies. But it always exists somewhere. There is no country in the world in which everything can be provided for by the laws, or in which political institutions can prove a substitute for common sense and public morality. Differences between the position of the President of the United States and that of a constitutional king of France. The executive power has so important an influence on the destinies of nations that I am inclined to pause for an instant at this portion of my subject in order more clearly to explain the part it sustains in America. In order to form an